There you go. This. Literally bought it because look how nice that's here.
That tin is lovely. All gold and blue and it looks kind of very vintage.
Yeah. So you've got that. And then like this stuff from Ajinomoto is more crystalline.
Mm.
And again, like, it's in a little panda.
Yeah, yeah, they did well with it. I enjoy that very much.
Basically, yeah. But like I said, it comes in all different forms. Like if I open my cupboard for you briefly, like this MSG in so many different ways. Like you've got
Maggi seasoning.
Two types of Maggi seasoning, hot and non-hot. Aromat. I don't know if you've seen this baby, but this is kind of like, I think it's Swiss.
Right, yes.
So it's basically MSG mixed with celery salt and various other things. That's a table seasoning.
That's the table seasoning, wow.
But literally, I never use it. I just like the jar.
Yeah, herbs and spices carefully selected to bring out the best in your cooking. Wow, interesting. And then there's a green panda here.
Oh, that's
different.
It's the Lunar New Year anniversary dragon.
Panda, right.
Did you notice? I like my packaging. But then, like, if you look at these, all these stock cubes. These are like, so that one is from Portugal. That one is from Mexico. MSG in them, and basically I'm like an MSG tourist. Like I have to get you know, people love going
like supermarkets
when they're holiday anyway. I always make a beeline for the stock cubes because I want to see what have they got, and if it's got MSG in it, I'm like, yeah, I'll buy that. And if it says no MSG, I'm like, no, because there's obviously other issues around here.
Yes,
if you're actually labeling it as no MSG, because you don't have to use it. I don't care if you don't use it, but if you're using no MSG as a selling point, there's
something else going on.
I'm not cool with that.
This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearlove. We live in an era where food ingredients and additives have never been more discussed and more contested. There's room for a healthy, informed discussion about transparency and good practice within our food systems, sure, but so much of this conversation is often laced with sensationalism and misinformation. And this is never more true than when it comes to one thing, MSG, or monosodium glutamate. Since I've been making Lekka, a thread I keep following is the way in which structures and systems of the wider world make their way into domestic space and influence what happens in our home kitchens. And when it comes to store cupboard ingredients, no other single ingredient has been subject to as much controversy.
Hello, my name is Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, a writer and academic who is particularly interested in looking at ingredients as a way to understand the world we live in.
I'm handing over to Anna for this mini-series, 5 episodes looking at the food heritage of East and Southeast Asian communities in the UK through the lens of umami and the ingredient MSG. It's the culmination of a year of research that's led Anna to interview a huge range of people, read some really interesting pieces of research, and look at how other cultures and countries have influenced the food of Britain. So often the conversation around MSG is very polarised and framed as a debate, a yes or no on whether MSG is healthy or dangerous, when really it's been proven to be a completely safe ingredient for years now. For so long, people of East and Southeast Asian heritage in particular have been subject to racism as a result of misinformation around this simple ingredient. In this mini-series, we wanted to open out the conversation around MSG and find a breadth of new ways for us to think about its usage within cooking and its importance within cultural heritage. Welcome to To Be Delicious, a cultural context of MSG in the UK.
For this first episode, we speak with writer, activist and chef Mimi A., who we heard at the top of the episode, showing us all her different MSG products. Mimi has been challenging the narrative around MSG for a number of years, through cooking and demystifying the ingredient. Lucy and I were lucky enough to be cooked a Burmese feast by Mimi, where she explained how and when she uses MSG, as well as talking us through the various stereotypes that are attached to the seasoning.
Read a specific dish. See, this is flummoxing me somewhat, as it's like you asking someone else to make a dish that uses salt. For cuisines and cultures that use MSGs, a Lao, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Filipino, it's a no-brainer alongside salt and pepper. It's used in pretty much any savoury dish as a matter of course. You're not meant to taste it or know it's there, but as with salt, you might say, I think this needs a dash of MSG. And this extends to any other cuisine that we cook. So I'll use it in spag bol, in shepherd's pie, and eggs benedict. But I will come up with something that's delicious and crowd-pleasing for listeners.
My origin story is that I had a blog because everyone had a blog. To be honest, in the UK, when I started, which was like 2010, 2009, I think there were only about 30 food blogs in the whole country. Can you imagine a time?
As Mimi cooked, she told us the background of how she got into food writing.
Most of our blogs were like a mishmash of things. Mine certainly was. So I had restaurant reviews, I had recipes, I had reviews of TV. But it was also when Twitter dawned. You had your blog, but then when you were on Twitter, you were able to connect with people that you wouldn't necessarily have ever had the chance to before. I mean, it's much less the case now. You could be talking to, I don't know, Rick Stein or, I don't know, Nigella Lawson or whatever, and they were obviously incredibly naive and would respond to you if you posted stuff or you had conversations. Bamisfit has a lot of kind of connections and overlaps with different cuisines. I liked investigating that and finding out where stuff had come from and vice versa, you know. Then I got approached by a publisher who said, would you like to write a book for us about noodles? Then I thought to myself, oh, hang on a bit, it's noodles, so I tell you what, I'm going to shoehorn loads of Burmese recipes into this. Because I had literally no inkling that I would ever end up being able to write a Burmese cookbook. You know, even when I was researching the noodle, the other noodles, it was quite nice to discover that there are other cuisines in Asia that use MSG, or chicken powder, or mushroom powder, or pork seasoning, or whatever, which is, all, like I said, it's all the same thing anyway. My agent asked me to write a book proposal early on, and she said that, you know, there isn't really a Burmese cookbook out there. And so she said, can you write this proposal for me? And then she basically just had it and just sent it around, I think probably annually. And then she rang me up and I was like, oh, why is she ringing me? Because she usually emails me stuff. And then she went, oh yeah, you've got a book deal for your Burmese cookbook. And I went, what? And then I thought, oh crap, I better do this properly. I managed to do that thing that a lot of people dream of. Because I got to go and see my boss and say to her, yeah, I'm leaving because I've got a book deal. Everywhere I've worked, I've never really worked with foodies. And I think they always see what I do as some kind of bizarre aberration. It's like, which I don't mind because yeah. I quite like having a different identity. It's like being a rubbish superhero, you know? When I was thinking about what I was going to make for you today, I had this long list, and then I was kind of going, I have to like work out what balances what, because like I didn't want too many things that were too sour, I didn't want too many things that were too spicy. So I'm hoping what I've got together is something that, if you have a little bit of everything, you understand how it combines and how it plays off against each other. I guess the main proteins, we've got two main curries. Now, curry is a terrible loaded word, I know, but that's is easier for us to say.
Yeah.
In Burmese, we call it hing. Hing is kind of less loaded than curry. It just means a dish of some sort. So we've got bamboo shoot and pork curry, and we have egg curry that I have to construct because I've got the eggs here and then the sauce I've been simmering separately. I've also got like braised butter beans. The way we like to do it is we kind of braise it, and then we end up crisping it. So some of it is crunchy, some of it is caramelized, and some of it is still kind of soft and mushy. Veggies, you'd normally have two types of veggies. So we have got chestnut mushrooms, but normally we would have straw mushrooms and water spinach, but I couldn't get hold of either. So you've got a slightly anglicized version. Then we also have to have crudités on the side because you just need to have a plate of crunchy veg, a raw veg. And the reason is because your sauces, your curries are usually quite kind of intense or rich, and you need something to cool it down. And when I say cool it down, I don't mean even that it's spicy, it's just cutting through that, you know, intensity of flavor. And then a salad, you always have to have a salad. Salads is almost always veggie again. I have made a grapefruit salad. And then the last thing is a whole bunch of fritters.
Ooh.
Because we really like frying things and we really, really like deep frying things. So what we normally get is you'd get like an array. So I am gonna make chickpea tofu fritters, vada fritters, and what was the last one? Oh, courgette fritters.
Oh my goodness.
And again, the courgette fritter is a replacement because normally we'd have a gourd of some sort, like a bottle gourd, but I couldn't get hold of it because I live in the sticks and I can't always. what I'm making for you, I guess, it gets called like a tamir wine. Tamir wine means like a, literally means rice roundness, because traditionally the Burmese table, eating table, is a round wooden table on the floor. So we actually sit kind of like cross-legged or squatting, or with like our legs touched to the side. And the idea is that you would have rice kind of as a centerpiece, because rice is life. And then loads and loads of little side dishes. And what we like to do for Burmese food is we like to have lots of different textures, lots of different cooking techniques, and lots of different kind of flavours and ingredients. And then when you eat it, we use our hands, and then we'll kind of mix and match from the side dishes. So we're not necessarily having the same experience with each mouthful.
Is there a balance of different kind of textures and flavours?
Yes, very much so.
I like the idea as well that you, every person who comes to this table will have a different eating experience, because they're going to combine everything in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, this stir fry, as I said, it is a mushroom and a green leafy veg, and you can mix up what the mushroom and the green leafy veg is. But pretty much the only season we use is a little bit of salt and a little bit of MSG, and then oil and garlic. But it's kind of funny because, like, we don't use, Burmese people don't use soy sauce very much.
Okay.
We use fish sauce and we use shrimp paste. So, you know, when we're trying to get our umami in, everything's quite funky. But soy sauce isn't really a thing unless it is a Chinese influenced dish. Because obviously we are paying respect to where the dish actually came from. You know, we will eat everything and anything, and it doesn't have to be, it can be a curry, it can be a salad, it can be noodles, just whatever we fancy. If we like it, we'll adopt it and we'll adapt it. We're led by our stomachs. So it's kind of funny though, because like when we adapt stuff, 9 times out of 10, we still call it by the original name. We have like this whole range of rice noodle dishes, which we really love, which are called mishe dishes. But that's from, I'm going to butcher his pronunciation, but that's from the Chinese noodle mishan.
Okay,
So we don't try and hide that we've stolen it.
It's kind of... But I guess it's probably because of migrants coming through Burma and Myanmar, and historically being a place of trade and...
I mean, you know, the country was incredibly rich. It was like the rice bowl of Asia at one point. One of the other things that I always find quite interesting about Burmese food is it's very regionalised. So, like, the food I cook is Upper Burma, because that's where my parents' families are from. And so, like, when we make salads, we make them with onions. Whereas if you're a Lower Burma, you make it with cucumber, because that's where it's grown.
Mm.
One of the reasons we like using MSG in Burmese food is because I guess it's cleaner, in a way. Because it doesn't have the other flavours that, like, nutritional yeast has, right?
Yeah.
So that'll make things cheesy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the flavour that, like, mushroom powder has, which makes things mushroomy. Or even chicken powder, because you've got chicken fat in it. We're not really a vegetarian or vegan country, but there are a lot of people that don't eat meat. And so it's just a lot easier to just fry some veggies up, bung them a bit of salt, bung in a bit of MSG, Bob's your uncle. Right.
And then you get to really taste the flavour of the vegetables.
That's the thing.
You actually get to taste the flavour of the mushroom, becomes more mushroomy.
Exactly. Because the point about MSG is it is a flavour enhancer, right? It's not meant to be the star of the show. And if it's the star of the show, something's gone horribly wrong. In terms of MSG, what you even call it, we call it a chow mong. Now, chow mong means sweet powder. But when we say sweet, we don't mean kind of desserts or sugary. Sweetness for us means more kind of how tasty something is.
Hitting the spot.
Yes, exactly.
Sweet spot. You're hitting the sweet spot.
Exactly. So, like, if something doesn't have enough of either MSG or umami or salt or anything, if something's lacking, we say in Burmese, we say bore. And bore literally means it's too light. So, like, it's insubstantial. This meal is insubstantial. You need something to kind of get it to hit the right spots, like you said. And so a chow mong, even though it's usually translated as sweet powder, you actually should be taste powder. Because you say to someone, a chow deela, and that means, is it to your taste? You're not saying, has it got enough MSG in it? Mm. Or is it sweet enough? You're saying, how do you feel about it? And because we like to carry this ethos all the way to the table, I mean, like, there is a noodle dish, which is my absolute favourite, called banh le mishe, and it is probably the one with the most fixings. So you have all the fixings as you make it, but you have loads of fixings at the table as well. And it is the one that's the most messed about with, I guess. So, like, if you get six people together, none of the bowls will taste the same. Mm. One of the things that you put in it is kind of garlic puree. And I'm always like whacking loads because it's raw garlic. Mm. It's not like crispy or anything. It's literally raw garlic puree, but I just love it. Mm. So, like, I'm just putting like two spoonfuls in, and my mum's like, "You just, what is wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, it's my taste, mum." And then I've got another cousin who will just like put ladles of chili oil into stuff, and then we go, "Do you even have a tongue anymore?" Mm.
When looking at cooking and MSG, the topic across so many of the interviews addressed the question of flavour. What does flavour mean to you? When talking about Burmese cooking with Mimi, the common thread was about how to build individual flavour. There is a confidence in knowing what her tastes are. MSG enhances flavour, and there is a sense of fun with food, trying to find out what works for you. Flavour is a complex, personal, nuanced thing. MSG can be the starting point for us to experiment what flavour means to us.
Watching you cook, and we're talking about MSG, and a lot of people think of MSG as like the trick seasoning or the way to kind of get things flavour in quickly, and yeah, and always like as a cheat.
Yeah.
But of course it's not, looking at how much, you know, all this takes a lot of labour and time and thinking and work.
Yeah.
And MSG is just a part of something. It's not getting a shortcut in any way.
It's just a type of salt. Yeah. You know, monosodium glutamate, sodium chloride. You know, you can make anything sound terrifying and chemical if you want to. And like salt, you just use it in a way to enhance your cooking, you know. Yeah. If not, I'm not going to go around, like, shaking people saying, "Don't put salt in this! How dare you!" You know, so when people get vexed about MSG being and stuff, you kind of want to go, right, yeah. You know, if you don't want things to taste good, that's fine. I mean, you don't have to use MSG. There are different sources, you know, like it was originally extracted from what, seaweed, I think. So if you want to use your dashi and your kombu and all that kind of stuff, go for it, you know. But on the other hand, there is a very easy form of it, so you might as well use that very easy form of it.
Exactly.
It's used by companies, right? So Pringles, I machine them. Oxo's got MSG in them, Bisto's got MSG in them.
Yeah, but it's not an automatic cheat. It's not like this thing that people think of as like, "Oh, well, I can't be bothered cooking, I'll just throw MSG in and that'll be sorted."
Oh no, completely not. The only time I ever personally use it as like a cheat is when I'm making popcorn.
Ooh.
It's really, really good. If you like salty popcorn, just add a little bit of MSG as well.
Oh my goodness, yes.
That's it, just when it's like freshly popped and it just kind of, ooh,
melts in.
That's
nice.
Yeah. That's a really dirty way of using MSG. but other than that, you know, whatever.
There is a public fear around additives, enhancers, rooted in genuine concern over previous food scandals and recalls, but then is projected onto other ingredients where it isn't relevant. One such example is the E number. Something commonly understood to be artificial additives, such as colouring, but is actually simply a system of categorisation of ingredients added to food for various reasons. It includes E164 saffron, E100 curcumin, derived from turmeric, and E901 beeswax, and of course, E621 monosodium glutamate. There are ingredients within these categories that we could ask questions about when they're added into our food, but simply being assigned an E number does not mean something is bad for us.
I'm going to use this oil to cook my chilies, to make my chili oil or my burnt chili oil. Basically, it's like a layered volcano. So, chili oil, you've got two types of chili flakes in there. You've got kind of plain chili flakes, and I've also got chipotle chili flakes because Burmese people use a smoked type of chili flakes, which I can't get at the moment. And then there's also salt in there, there's some paprika, and then the most important thing is the MSG. So I'm just gonna put, and again, this is another one of those things where you do it to taste. So some people might like it a bit saltier, some people might like it a bit more MSG. It's up to you. Most commercially available chili oil also has MSG in it.
But you've put about a bit more salt and a bit more paprika to MSG.
I mean, the paprika is more for colour than anything else. So, like, in Burmese, we call it a yang dim mok, which means colour enhancing powder, which is a very weirdly mundane name. Salt is also incredibly important in chili oil, but the MSG is just kind of like the kick. So you need the kick.
Watching Mimi cook was a way to really understand how MSG works. This idea of a kick in a chili oil, the concept of an enhancer. Salt is seen in this way, but why isn't MSG? Is it because of the name? Does it sound scientific and therefore intimidating or not real? So what actually is MSG?
My name is Kumiko Ninomiya and I am a member of Umami Formation Center. And my title is Executive Fellow, and I am always support the activity by Umami Formation Center.
To understand MSG, we need to know what umami is. Umami is one of our five basic tastes, along with sweet, sour, salty, bitter.
Umami is one of the basic tastes, and there are three major umami substances. One is glutamate. Glutamate is one of amino acids, and other two umami substances are inosinate and guanylate. So inosinate is rich in animal-based food like meat or fish, and guanylate is very, very rich in dried mushrooms like dried shiitake mushroom or dried porcini.
I was lucky to speak with Dr. Ninomiya at the Umami Information Center, which is a global independent center established in 1982 to disseminate, collect information based on science, and tell the world about umami.
And glutamate is the most important substance which impart umami. And glutamate is found in many kinds of food, including vegetables, seaweeds, fermented foods like cheese, miso, soy sauce, and fish and meat. Almost all foods have glutamate. So every day you eat foods with umami. So tomato and cheese are often used for Italian food. So every people enjoy umami taste. So in the UK, people love to eat Marmite. That's very, very rich in umami taste.
Dr. Ninomiya has been working at the Umami Information Center since 1985 and has seen how people have understood umami and in turn MSG over time.
The name umami was first used by Professor Kikunae Ikeda, who discovered umami in 1908. So this kind of information are all based on scientific data. So that's why we need talk about umami based on science, not commercial talk. In 2002, American scientists discovered umami receptor on our tongue. So this was a very epoch-making discovery. Before that, some scientists said that I don't believe umami is a basic taste, because umami is a very unique taste only found in Japanese cuisine, or only Japanese people can feel umami.
Dr. Ninomiya explained to me that this 2002 discovery confirming the umami taste receptor was a huge change in the way umami was understood, particularly in the West. It was the moment that she started to take the conversation around umami outside of the academic space. And chefs were the best people to engage with this conversation. She organized a series of dinners with Nobu Matsuhisa of Nobu Restaurants. And in 2008, the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of umami, she organized a symposium in the US that included the chef Thomas Keller.
I explained about who discovered umami. So that is Kikunae Ikeda, and he tried to find the key taste component in Japanese soup stock dashi, and he started experiment to extract the taste component from dried seaweed kombu. And he found that glutamate is the key taste component, and he named the taste umami. And he also developed new product, MSG. And he tried to make potassium glutamate, sodium glutamate, calcium glutamate, or ammonium glutamate. And he found that monosodium glutamate is the best because it's easy to soluble in water and very clear umami taste. MSG first coming from kombu, and now it's produced by fermentation. It's very natural.
The tofu fritters, we tend to do them in like either triangles or rectangles.
Okay.
And then we might kind of poke a couple of holes in them like you do in pastry to let the steam out.
At what point do you put the MSG in?
It depends. So like when for the tofu fritters, you actually put it in when you're making the tofu. So when you're kind of mixing up that tofu mix of gram flour, various other seasonings, the MSG goes in there as one of the seasonings. Mm-hmm. For the others, it's a batter thing. So yeah, you'll put it into the batter and then you'll get the veggies and you'll kind of put it in that kind of mixed up batter. It kind of depends also what type of MSG you're using, because like a lot of people like using kind of chicken powder, which is basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then that's the chickpea tofu, which I made yesterday, because you have to make it in advance and then it has to set in the fridge. Very oddly, it's basically the same as like panis or panel. So it's gram flour that's just been kind of cooked in a sort of polenta type thing with seasoning, like I said, with the MSG and salt and a little bit of turmeric, just to get that golden colour again. And yeah, basically you cook it up in a saucepan quickly, because if it takes too long, it then starts to cook properly and it won't set. So you cook it up quite quickly and then you pour it into your prepared tub and then you let it cool down a bit and then you put it in the fridge and hope it sets. And again, it's one of those things where sometimes it doesn't set for no apparent reason. So and I like the kind of the risk involved with making baby sweets sometimes.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
After watching Mimi cook all afternoon, seeing the different dishes come together, watching as the different textures were created, we sat down to eat. And I thought about the ideas of balance, of thinking about what my personal palate enjoyed, and created a plate of food, a combination of the dishes that was unique to me and my tastes and the flavours I liked. Needless to say, it was all delicious. My favourite was the pork dish. The richness was wonderful in contrast to the fresh, cut, crunchy veg, carrots, radishes, sugar snaps. Whilst we ate, we discussed the way MSG is perceived in Western food culture and how or if it had changed. Mimi has been a champion of MSG. For me, it has felt like she was almost a one-man band of demystifying and challenging the misinformation for a number of years. She did this through her social media platforms, being the guest editor for Pip Magazine's MSG issue, and of course her MSG podcast. In later episodes, we'll dive into how it became a racist trope. But with Mimi, I wanted to know how she navigated this conversation on a personal level and reflect on what has changed.
My MSG journey. I guess I started kind of posting about it on my blog. I was just putting down the recipes that I knew, and they did contain MSG. And I think at the time, I didn't actually know necessarily that there was any kind of controversy about it, because, you know, this is just what I grew up with. Seems totally normal to me, so I'm going to write about it. And every so often I get like a comment on my blog, okay, what can I use instead of MSG? But there wasn't like any kind of aggressive pushback. And so I'd always go, oh, I don't know, you can use like a bit of Marmite or Marigold Bouillon, or, you know, there are so many like substitutes you can use. And then maybe, I don't know, a little bit later on, I did start getting the odd comment from people saying, oh, you shouldn't use MSG, it's bad for you, but with no elaboration. Sometimes an anonymous comment, but I did feel a little bit kind of hounded by them because I started thinking, oh, maybe there is an issue. And but the thing is, like, I never thought I was in the wrong. This is probably like massive arrogance on my part, but I just thought, these people are just weird. I'm just going to ignore them. Or if it was someone who's using like their real username or like their real name, I'd be like, well, that's not necessarily true. I'd post that link to that article that was written probably around the same time, maybe earlier. I think it was Alex Renton, The Guardian, saying that if MSG causes all this, why aren't a billion people in China have migraines?
I'm Alex Renton, and I'm an investigative journalist in all sorts of areas, but the most fun that I've had is investigating food and food scares and food anthropology, I think, is one way of putting it.
This is Lucy again. While we were recording Anna's script for this episode, we decided it would be really interesting context to ask Alex Renton if he would answer a couple of questions about this article that Mimi's talking about. It was published in the Observer Food Monthly in July 2005, and the title was, as Mimi alluded to, If MSG is so bad for you, why doesn't everyone in Asia have a headache? When I contacted Alex, he told me the title was actually a reference to a piece Jeffrey Steingarten had written a couple of years before. Alex and I ended up having a really interesting and quite extensive conversation about MSG, which we won't include in its entirety here, but we're going to publish a longer version of this conversation on the Lex Substack, as we found it so interesting to hear his reflections almost 20 years on from the publication of the original article. But here are a few thoughts from Alex.
So I and my then young family moved to Bangkok in 2001. I had a job doing policy and comm stuff for Oxfam across East Asia. The cafe where we all have lunch with the Oxfam staff outside the office had, next to the chopped dried chili, a little pot of white powder called Ajinomoto on every table. So I arrived there, you know, like everyone else in the West, going, ooh, MSG, yuck, Chinese restaurant syndrome, oh, you know, horrible symptoms. Very quickly started discussing it with Thais I knew and so on, and they were going, what are you talking about? You know, I've only got a chemistry O-level, but it's very easy to find out what MSG is. You know, it's a salt of an amino acid that the body produces itself. And so the logical leap from that to saying artificially produced, in quotes, MSG is the problem, kind of made no sense at all when you realize that artificially produced just means industrially produced, but, you know, by a fermenting process, often using yeast. And Marmite, favorite substance of mine, is yeast extract and very high in glutamate. I'm a health conscious omnivore, and I'm picky about what I eat, and there are foods that I absolutely will not touch. I haven't eaten salmon, farmed salmon, which is kind of all you can get, for decades. And I don't eat highly processed food, and I cook. I like that, and I'm probably a bit snobbish about it and a bit lectury. But I do love a cheesy Watsit. Ooh. Oh, I can eat three packets. It's very easy as a food lover to latch on to one scare and use that as a sort of benchmark, as a sort of trigger point to make points about being healthier in our diets. But when it's a little harder work, or we have to avoid something we actually enjoy, we don't do it. My editor, Nicola Gill, who brilliant woman who founded the Observer Food Monthly, you know, she loved it. You know, it's a counterintuitive idea which would get people talking, and it certainly did. I mean, and I certainly got abuse. I mean, not least from people who, you know, simply knew that MSG did harm them, because when they went to a Chinese restaurant, they would emerge with all these well-known symptoms. Well, I think it must have looked like snobbery and sort of racist as well. And I think what we're into a really interesting area around nocebo effects and crowd panic effects. You know, the explanation then, which I never really kind of credited, was but this is unusual food and perhaps more spice than people are used to, and this might explain their reaction. But I think, no, I mean, it's, you know, you read that this may do this to some people, and then if it does it to you, that you know, that's it. It's the human condition that you make such a connection.
Back at the table with Mimi, she's talking about her experience of this time around when Alex wrote the article in online spaces like Twitter.
On Twitter, people were more aggressive, and you get the odd people, the odd person that didn't even follow me, who would, they must have been like searching for the acronym, who would just suddenly start citing all the things that it does, not necessarily to them, sometimes to their wife's doctor's husband's brother. And it was invariably either like someone who was really into crystals, that sounds really bad, or or an American. It was usually those two types of people. And
I've got a visual image.
And so, you know what I mean? Like, the kind of white person that has dreadlocks. But then, like, later on, people were starting to talk about it, or people who I respected and I knew either didn't mind about MSG or actually actively used it, would be really cagey about it and would stop talking about it or pretend they didn't use it. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but I kind of started to feel like I was the only chump around who was brave enough to say, I actually do use it. And so there was a brief period of time where I was kind of the person lost in the wilderness, kind of sounding like a crank. And then, you know, there were the odd ally from other parts of the world. So you'd get Adam Lior, is he Australian? I should know that. But he is also quite a big MSG advocate, and he would post the similar threads with all the science and the evidence behind it, and he'd get the same kind of stick. You get David Chang in America, again, posting in favour of it. And then, you know, you've got Anthony Bourdain literally saying, you know what Chinese restaurant syndrome is, it's racism, right? But even that just wasn't enough. It got to the point where I was having to post constant threads with the same information each time, always with the disclaimer that I don't actually care if you don't use MSG, but you need to acknowledge that 9 times out of 10, you're against it because you're racist. And then I think there was a little bit of a tide turning where they even started pulling back a little bit. So like David Chang would say, oh yeah, I use MSG at home, but I'd never use it in my restaurant. And then, so a friend of mine, she wanted to start a podcast. I didn't want to. And then she suggested that we call it the MSG pod. The MSG, we always claimed that it stood for mildly spicy gossip, right? So
perfect, perfect.
At the time, I didn't feel like there was a platform for us to voice anything apart from like on Twitter. Mm. If we wanted to talk about MSG not being a bad thing, if we wanted to talk about how COVID wasn't just Chinese people, if we wanted to talk about any of those things, there wasn't really any other way for us to get our voices out.
And also in those spaces, like on Twitter, as you know, suggested, it gets really aggressive.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to talk about these things and these topics, partly just sharing who you are and your culture and your history,
yeah,
and then being attacked.
Yeah.
By it. So it's not even really, so even that as a platform is quite sort of a dangerous space.
Oh, it's horrible.
It does feel like that MSG is very racially charged.
Yeah. And it has actually kind of got to the point where, like, when there is someone talking about it who is not Asian, like, half of me is really pissed off because I'm like, oh, they're finally listening. But half of me is really grateful because I'm like, they're finally listening. Right? So it's just such a mixed feeling. Which I, you know, it's really hard to reconcile. When I was editing the MSG issue of Pitt magazine, I found out a bit more about the science because I felt like I ought to be able to like riposte a little bit better. And so I found out that, for example, monosodium glutamate only has like the salt in there to stabilize it, really. And so as soon as it hits liquid, i.e. water, i.e. your mouth, it's exactly the same as natural glutamate. So, yeah, when you look at it, you know, in a bowl, the crystals, ooh, they're so scary. Yeah, fine, you might think that's a chemical. And it's not the same as this lovely bowl of Parmesan or whatever. But as soon as it's in your gob, it's the same thing, literally. So, you know, that was quite a useful and handy thing to find out. It's used neat in a lot of places, but it's also used as part of, like, other seasonings. So, like, all over Eastern Europe, it's in different forms. So there's something called kuturak, there's something called vegeta. There are lots of kind of barbecue grill powders. In Iceland, it's on something called potato salt. which is on the table in every cafe.
It's representative of the shifting narrative around MSG that establishment TV chef and author Rick Stein included it in the ingredients of his recent book, Simple Suppers. In an interview, Stein admitted that he has been reluctant to admit he cooks with it in the past, telling an interviewer, "I've never put MSG in any of my recipes before, just because I don't want people to say, 'How could you do this?' But the reality is, it's not dangerous. I just thought it was time I actually pointed this out to people." With this shifting perception, there is now an element of coolness to using MSG, and with it, a rise of new producers that are making it.
So I've been seeing all these kind of products suddenly. I keep getting ads, and probably because I talk about it all the bloody time, but I've been getting ads for new products which are MSG products, and it's the kind of mixes that I use in my cooking on a daily. So like there's sugar, salt and MSG, there's salt, pepper and MSG, and then there's salt, chili and MSG, and you know, I'm all for it. But then you go to the kind of, these people use MSG and it's all white people. So it's like, oh. Angie Bourdain loves it, and Grant Akatz, I don't know, is it Akatz or Chats, the guy from Alinea.
Oh,
he loves it. Heston Blumenthal loves it. And I get why they've chosen those people. But at the same time, it's kind of like...
Mm. Is this the only way to legitimise it? Is it a white man says it's okay?
Exactly. A white man says it's okay.
But there's also a thing of like, in a way, it feels like it's unfair to me to be, to just walk in on the MSG story when it's at a good point, having not been part of or experienced or your friends experienced, your parents experienced the kind of racial hate that has come with it. And to just be like, artisan, MSG for you all. And now we're on board.
But this is the thing, I mean, then it's not just MSG, right? It's any cuisine,
yes.
Right?
One of the things I have noticed with the change in how MSG is viewed is a rise in how it is used on social media, almost casually, normalising it, which is great. But very rarely any context about what MSG is and its racialized history. There's a sense of rebellious coolness that upholds hierarchies of food. We'll get to this in the next episode. But it was so refreshing to watch Mimi cook, where MSG is an integral ingredient in a thoughtful, considered approach in the kitchen that she's been clearly using for a long time. The food she makes is wholesome, homely. MSG contains multitudes. And when do you think the conversation around MSG has changed?
You know what? Literally this year. And the only reason I think that is because, like, a current, like, one of those, what do you call them? Like, current affairs, TV, soft, like, entertainment things asked me to come and do a segment on MSG.
Ah.
On the BBC.
Right.
So I went, I filmed it, I did it. It was a surprisingly long segment, actually. So I spent like a whole day filming. And then when it actually aired, it was about 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did not think, I thought they were going to pull it at the last minute. Even after they filmed it, I thought they were going to pull it. Because I thought, come on, man. You want to talk about Boyzone's new tour or something. You know. And then they aired it. And then they aired it. And then they posted about it on Facebook, they posted it on Instagram, they posted about it on Twitter. Not a single pushback. That is the first time.
Wow.
That has ever happened whenever I've said anything about MSG. The fact that all of these kind of initiatives have been done, people are getting more interested, it's a good thing.
Mm.
And, you know, even if there is some bad stuff and bumps along the way.
Yeah, slightly problematic moments.
Yeah.
Still heading in the right direction.
Yeah, I do think so. But like, this is the first time I've actually felt that.
Mm.
Because before that, it's always been a bit kind of, I mean, put it this way. Well, this thing that aired on the BBC, it was also purely positive, right? Whereas I had done stuff on radio before and they'd both sided it. It was very much, and here's the point of view of someone who doesn't believe that MSG is good for you for no reason at all.
Yeah.
And then they'd get as much airtime, and then you kind of feel like, this is not a debate, you know. None of the food standards agencies have said it was unsafe, you know. It's not marked as an allergen when it's in an ingredient. Like, this should be a no-brainer, but for some reason it's not.
Why do you love
love to cook with it.
I mean, why would you deprive yourself of a source of flavour, right? If you want your food to taste good, use every single thing that is available to you, and MSG is just one of those things.
Next time on To Be Delicious.
I've just never really been shy of trying new things, and like, I think my mum has definitely led me to believe that just because some ingredients belong to a cuisine typically doesn't mean that you can't cross-pollinate. And you know, she would add nook mum to like spaghetti bolognese and like things like that, where if you like a flavour, then why not just add it to everything?
To Be Delicious was presented by me, Dr. Anna Sulan-Mussing, and produced for Lekker by me and Lucy Dearlove. Our original theme music was composed by Midori Yeager. Our podcast artwork was by Natasha Pang Lee. This project was made possible by the support of the European Committee for Umami and Ajinomoto. If you've enjoyed this series, you'll also enjoy my forthcoming book, Chinese and Any Other Asian, Exploring East and Southeast Asian Identity in Britain, out next month, which you can pre-order now. Find the link in the show notes for this episode.